The first of our afternoon speakers is a great honour to welcome. That is Benoit Felton, who joins us from Yankee Group. Look, there is a brief description about Benoit in the paper, but everything you really want to know about Benoit, you'll find out on his blog, which is Fibre Evolution, all as one word with only one E, .com. Good place to have a read. You guys have already been written up on it once, and no doubt there'll be more about you in the next few days, I guess. Benoit, is that correct? So, without any further ado, Benoit's going to talk about the simplest topic of the whole day, of the whole 2 days, open access. It was the thing that had the most different versions and interpretations in the submissions that the Commerce Commission received. The good news is that Benoit is not going to define it. He's just going to tell us all why it makes economic sense. So could you please welcome Benoit?
I guess I have three thank yous first. The first is to the Commission for having me here. It's a great honor. The second is to David for mentioning my blog. He'll get a few dollars from Google adverts from me. And the third is to you for staying. So I'll try to make this as entertaining and provocative as I can. And I'm going to try to define open access in there as well as define why it makes sense. Okay, so the first thing you need to know to understand the rest of this presentation is, even though I don't sound like it, I am French. Okay? And what we're known for is a couple of things. We're known for wine and cheese, although I have to say that the wine and cheese I had here is pretty damn good as well. We're known for fashion, and ladies, you can see that this is eminently wearable, French fashion. We're known for our strikes. And even though he's very small and you might not see him from that far away, we're known for... Oh, no, sorry, I missed one. So we're known for Zidane, of course. He's a bit more famous than Beckham. I'm sure he would have filled that stadium. And we're known for our diminutive president who wants to be the emperor of the world. But none of that is why I'm here today. I'm here because increasingly we are known for fiber. Now, before I move on to the next slide, and I'm trying to remember what the next slide is, the important thing is that, in fact, I've been, the last couple of days, I've been fuming at some of the comments, not because they were wrong, but because I wanted to answer these comments. And I'm going to try to do that through this presentation. I guess the point I want to make before I move to this next slide is we should stop saying that there's no business model to deploy FTTN, because there is, and I'm going to talk about that. And also that we should stop looking only, as much as I think it's really important to think about what the revenues are going to be on this new infrastructure, and you know that's one of the key areas of my research, but there's also other dynamics at hand. That's not the only thing that comes into the equation. So. If we think about copper today, we're seeing a number of things. First of all, copper was never designed to do broadband, and increasingly it's stretched to its limits. That means it's increasingly unreliable. One of its characteristics is it's strongly asymmetric. It's geographically constrained. You can't cover, not everybody who has copper can have broadband service, as we've seen these last 2 days. And increasingly, it's expensive to maintain because, as the previous speaker pointed out, sometimes it was laid out 100 years ago. If you look at fiber in comparison, the capacity that we can have over fiber is virtually unlimited. It's incredibly stable. That means that you don't get huge variations in the bandwidth that you get over broadband. It's potentially symmetric, depending on how you implement it. It's potentially ubiquitous because the attenuation is extremely low. And it's much cheaper to maintain. So that should lead us to one conclusion, which I will sum up with this picture. And if you take that on board, the question is not, how do we pay for the network? The question is, we have to deploy the next generation network because the old generation network is dying anyway. Once you've taken that on board, then you can start thinking about how is it going to pay for itself. But you have to accept first that this is not a choice. It's not a commercial choice. It's we're being forced into deploying these next generation networks. And sure, we might not need them next year. We might not need them in 2 years. But if we don't have them in 15 years, then we're going to be in big trouble. So having said that, Let's look at the business model. And I'm not saying that this business model looks, you know, extremely sexy. If it did, we wouldn't be here. One of the things that we hear very often from incumbents is that any form of network sharing is economically detrimental to them. They usually put that in words slightly prettier than what I just did, but that's what it comes down to. Now, in the next two slides, what I want to do is, first of all, to illustrate why very clearly copper unbundling has been profitable to incumbents, and second, to see what this teaches us about the fiber business model. Okay, so I took France as an example because that's where I live, and also because if the assertion is unbundling was unprofitable, you just have to find one example to prove that that assertion is wrong. So I'm using that one. This is broadband growth in France, and I hope the figures are big enough. This is broadband growth in France over the last 9-10 years. Now, you might wonder, why is there a big inflection point in 2002? Here, June 14th, 2002. Anyone has a guess what that date was? Sorry?
That's actually the first day for enactment of the European regulatory framework. Not the day it was implemented
in France. No, well, you might be right, but the relevance to the French market, is that that was the day where the unbundling tariffs were finalized by the regulator and put in place. Now, you can see this clear inflection on the market. Now, if I do a little bit of Uchronia and wonder what would have happened if unbundling hadn't been put in place, and I look at the growth trend before that date, this is what I come up with. So effectively, we would have something like a little above 5 million broadband customers in France if unbundling hadn't been put in place, based on the growth rates that we had before unbundling. And we currently have a little short of 20 million. Now, considering the incumbent is 50% of that market share, and not even taking into account the fact that their wholesale division is so profitable that the competitive operators this year asked if this wasn't supposed to be cost-based, you can clearly see that they made a lot of money. And in fact, you could argue that the ARPUs were lower because of that competition. But actually, if you map the ARPU, you see that, sure, it's lower than it was in 2003, but it's catching up fast. It's growing again. So the first thing I want to present to you today is, let's stop with this argument that network sharing is inherently uneconomical. It isn't, very clearly. So now moving on to fiber. And I realize that the figures on this are very small, but I'm going to explain how this graph has to be read, and then I'm going to comment on it. So what you see here in this three-dimensional graph is, here you have take-up. So take-up is the proportion of the homes that you have connected to the network that actually subscribe to the service. Here you have ARPU, the biggest here and the smallest here. And that is the revenue that each paying customer contributes to your coffers. And here you have how long it takes to pay back. Now, obviously, this is a very simplistic model. I'm not going to pretend this is in-depth economic analysis. But it teaches us a number of really interesting things. And by the way, the assumptions here, which are in euro and not in New Zealand dollar, but you can substitute one for the other if you like, are that it costs you 1,000 euros to connect each home, and that you're making 45% gross margin on the service, on the retail service. Okay? So what does this tell us? Well, you can clearly see that this curve here shows that having a high take-up is more important to payback than having a high ARPU. And by the way, there's not a lot of European operators that have 75 euros ARPU today. In fact, there's none. So 75 euros is a really big ARPU. So you need to have a high take-up, and that's more crucial to you than to have a high ARPU. That's lesson number one. Lesson number two is, if we look at operators that have had a regulatory holiday, we see that usually their take-up is around 20 and 25% of the network. They rarely go above that, or at least once they reach that stage, it grows very, very slowly. 25% take-up. This puts us around here, okay? So you're going to be in the yellow zone here, which is a payback of 10 to 15 years. Is that acceptable to any telco? I don't know if there's any telcos in the room. But I think the answer is no. They don't want payback in 10 to 15 years. And then comes the last issue. And the last issue is that, as we have said, it's a lot more economical to run a fiber network than it is to run a copper network. But that only happens if I can disconnect the copper. And in order to disconnect the copper, I need to get 100% of my customers on the fiber. In fact, you will see that at 100%, it pays back really quick, less than 5 years. So how are you going to get 100% if you're an incumbent telco? The only way you're going to do it is if you're not the only one selling services over the network. So very clearly, this argument that we keep hearing, which is, if I invest in this, I need to be the only one to reap the rewards, is nonsensical. The real argument is, if I invest in this, I need as many people as possible to market, innovate, and sell services over my network, because that's the only way it's going to pay back in a reasonable amount of time. Now, there's another argument somewhere in there. If we say that 10 to 15 years is unacceptable to a telco, if we say that 5 to 10 years is unacceptable to a telco, and most would say that their shareholders would not agree to an 8 or 9 year payback plan, then that raises the question, maybe telcos are not the right guys to deploy this. Or at least, maybe they should be looking at their infrastructure business, their network business, differently than the way they look at their service business. And I'm leaving these questions up in the air for now, but obviously they're pretty crucial. This morning we heard from Joost from KPN. I wanted to put up here a quote by the CEO of KPN 3 weeks ago. I'll read it for you, although I'm sure you've read it already. But in hindsight, KPN made a mistake back in 1996. We were not too enthusiastic to be forced to allow competitors on our old wireline network. And I would say that's an understatement. That turned out not to be very wise. If you allow all your competitors on your network, all services will run on your network, and that results in the lowest cost possible per service, which in turn attracts more customers for those services, so your network grows much faster. An open network is not charity from us. In the long run, it simply works best for everybody. And what he's not saying here, but is obviously evident to any incumbent, is that the power of the brand means that the incumbent is going to have a majority share of that market no matter what happens. So by growing the pie, you make the whole system more economical, but you still deserve a pretty large share of that for yourself. Unless you're really, really crappy, but you know. So open access. It's actually pretty hard to define, and I'm going to do that in the next few slides. But first of all, I wanted to display all the models that I've come up with, that I've met, actually, you know, researching various operations around the world. What you see in green here is public money, public investment, public management. What you see in blue is private. And what's interesting is actually all models exist more or less no matter who's paying. So what we got here on the left, I guess I should insist on the three layers. So P is the passive layer, A is the active layer, and S is the services layer here. So what you have on the left is what I call the full municipal network, which is a vertically integrated public network. This is a model that I've only seen in the US, but I imagine there are other places where this might happen. Usually, when municipalities get into rolling out these networks, they don't necessarily think from day one, I'm going to provide services. But they find so little enthusiasm from service providers who feel cheated that they're deploying a network to actually provide services that they end up having to do it themselves. The second model, which is this one here, is a model where either a public body, a utility, or an operator deploy both the passive and the active, but then you have multiple service providers capable of offering services over that, which I guess is, in a way, the separated model that we see here and in the UK, although where exactly is the distinction between the passive and the active remains, I think, a question mark in these models. What I call passive open access, and I'm not going to spend too much time on this because I'm going to get back to it in a further slide, is a model where the passive is deployed either by public or private money, and then a multiplicity of players, can activate that. The municipal open access is what you find mostly in the Nordics in Europe, where the passive is leased for a long-term period to an active wholesaler who then provides access to various service providers. And then, of course, in the not-so-open models, you have the vertically integrated model, which is the traditional telco model. So what does this mean? Well, if you're looking at the passive access infrastructure, if you want to be in that play, you actually have to invest a lot of money. You have to invest money in ducts and poles, you have to invest money in dark fiber, and you have to pay for the fiber termination to every home. The lifetime of your investment is 25 years, and it's mostly a local game because you have to dig to put that in the ground. If you're on the active wholesale layer, you have to put in access and aggregation equipment, you have to have OSS, BSS, and you have to pay for CPEs. The lifetime of your investment was more like 5 years. And again, it's a relatively local game because it's tied to the network and you have to have a physical relationship of sorts with the customer. If you're on the service layer, your investment barrier is actually much lower. You have to invest in service platforms, probably in BSS, to provision your services and build them, but you don't have to invest all that much money. The lifetime of your investment is much shorter, and you can operate on a wider geographical basis because you're not physically tied to the network. And then what we tend to forget when we talk about open access is that internet access, assuming a net neutrality position, is a form of open access. And on the internet layer, your investment is even lower. The lifetime of your investment, again, is short. And your scope is potentially global because geography is more or less no longer an issue. We talked about peering this morning, so obviously there are a number of bottlenecks, but they're clearly not as complex to overcome. So when we look at remedies to ensure some form of open access, it's important to keep these things in mind, which is why this graph follows the same structure. So if you want to open the passive, you have to open the ducts, assuming they exist. Joost told us this morning there's no ducts in the Netherlands. So very clearly, if the ducts don't exist, this is not even a remedy that you can use. The impact of opening the ducts is as follows. You will probably get several players in dense areas because financially, it will still make sense for more than one operator to deploy fiber to a single customer. Now, when I say several, probably 2 to 3 is the maximum you're going to get. And this, of course, assumes that you have 2 to 3 players in the country willing and capable of investing. But what you're going to get in less dense areas is monopoly, at best, because in a lot of areas you'll get probably nothing. And what you'll end up with, more or less inevitably, is a patchwork network where the different deployments are actually managed and owned by different players. This is the model that's been pushed in Spain and France and is more or less pushed by the EU, although the EU's position is sometimes a little unclear. If you want to open the active, you have to open the dark fiber. This is a form of, no, sorry, if you want to open the passive one layer above the ducts, you have to open the dark fiber. So this is a new form of unbundling. Wherever the network goes, you will potentially get several service providers. And depending on the model that's chosen from day one, you might have only one network, if there's a clearly identified network player and that he's incentivized to roll out, or you might have several networks depending on the circumstances. So the Netherlands is a good example of that remedy being put in use. If you want to open the active, you have to make the lit fiber available. In theory, that results in a richer choice for customers, because as the investment barrier is lower, you have more players capable of providing services on that layer. You have potentially tens of service providers. But if we look at the history of Bitstream over DSL, it actually looks like there might be an issue here, because in fact, in every country where DSL was largely deployed, the Bitstream players died gradually. Is that because the regulation favored unbundling over Bitstream so much that it didn't leave any economic window for a Bitstream player to survive? Maybe. Is that because there are technical issues with Bitstream in terms of actually having some control over the infrastructure? Maybe. To be honest, I'm divided on that question. But there is, I think, an interrogation there if Bitstream is going to be the remedy. This is largely what the UK is trying to do, although it should be pointed out that the Ofcom is working on what they call active line access, which is an Ethernet level bitstream, which theoretically should allow the purchaser more control over the infrastructure. And then you can open the services on the IP layer, on the internet layer, where potentially you have hundreds of service providers. So, for example, in Sweden today, 450 service providers over broadband. I imagine the regulator is not too happy about that. It's a lot of people to regulate. So it's important to have this, to keep this in mind, because depending on how you operate the open access part of the network, you're going to get very different results. And all of the models that I described have one failing, I think, or at least they don't solve one part of the equation, which is that if you look at this graph with the funny little guys here, you can see that there's always, in these models, there's always one service provider for one customer. And on the wholesale layer, that's not very efficient, because it means that you're going to have a single source of revenue at a fixed rate, full stop. I think what the Sweden model shows, where they use IP and therefore they don't have that constraint and they have other issues, so I'm not saying IP is necessarily the solution, but I think there's somewhere in there, there's a model where you can have a multiplicity of service providers for each customer. And these don't necessarily have to be competing service providers on the same services, but this is how you're going to get your healthcare service, this is how you're going to get your e-education service, etc. And on the wholesale layer, this makes a whole lot more sense, because then I have multiple revenue streams and it becomes in my interest to foster the service environment so that customers can subscribe to more varied and more qualitative services. Again, I don't have the answer as to how you implement that technically, but I think there's a way of doing this. I'm digging, but I'm not an engineer, so it's kind of tricky. Okay, now, this is kind of a cheeky slide, but since as a country you're in the middle of a big question, which is we have this whole pot of money for next generation networks and we don't know how it's going to be spent, I'm going to demonstrate two ways which I think are interesting of using public money to ensure a healthy competitive environment and not end up with one player taking all the advantage of that, or an inefficient stranded asset. The two examples are what's happening in the 92 department in France, which is just on the west of Paris, and what Swisscom is doing. So in the 92 department, what they're doing is they are collaborating with a private party, so there's about 10% public money in this investment, to deploy last mile technology-neutral fiber infrastructure. What I mean by that is that an operator can come and connect to an aggregation point and access to all the customers that are covered by that aggregation point. Whether he's deploying point-to-point or PON doesn't matter. The infrastructure will allow him to continue with the technology choice that he's made. What I find interesting with this model is that there's still a relative level of investment that's required from the service provider. So in a way, it eliminates the risk of someone coming in with no investment at all and reaping an excessive amount of reward compared to the players who have invested in this market. And what I also find interesting is that it's a model where the public money is not actually financing a network per se, because these aggregation points are not connected by any form of network. They are independent tail ends, if you can look at them like that. I think that's an interesting model. Another model that's been very much publicized in the last few months is Swisscom's rollout, which they've announced back in December. What Swisscom has done, and just to understand the dynamics here, you have to understand that Swisscom is facing a lot of municipal competition. There are a lot of municipal networks have been deployed or are being deployed in Switzerland. And so it's very clear to Swisscom that their network, their next generation network, will not cover 100% of Switzerland. So their conundrum was, how can I have a homogeneous network over the whole country, even if I'm not deploying all of it? And their answer was to say, well, we, Swisscom, will deploy 4 fibers to every home. We will use one, the other 3 will be available for whoever wants to compete with us. But what we ask is for everybody else to deploy in the same way. And that way it ensures for Swisscom that there will be excessive fiber available. And by the way, they estimate that the cost of doing this is about 10% more than the cost of a traditional rollout. So it's not neutral, but it's not huge either. I'll let you ponder on that, but I think these are two models that are worth good scrutiny. So what are my key messages here? Number one, you only get one chance at laying out the infrastructure. I'm not advocating for waiting ages before you make your decisions, but I am saying the choices you're going to make, you're going to have to live with for 40 years. And that's true of private players, and it's true of the government and public players. So really, the implications of the choices you make are going to be considerable. The second thing is, as I think I demonstrated in my previous slide, if infrastructure competition is what you want, there are more than one way of doing that. And the usual one way being everybody spends a whole lot of money to connect the same customers. So that's worth thinking as well. The third point is, inevitably, you're going to end up with a patchwork network one way or another. You're going to have municipal networks, you're going to have rural networks, you're going to have maybe one public national network, but it won't reach everywhere. So it's very important from day one that these networks be interoperable. And I think this is of the responsibility of the public administration to make sure that whatever is deployed, it's deployed in a way that it's compatible with what's being deployed elsewhere. And finally, but I think I made that point already quite loudly, the choice is not between investment or competition. One of the things that I want to finish on, the one thing that I want to finish on actually, is one of the topics we've heard over the last couple of days is broadband as a utility. Now, a couple of weeks back, in a French newspaper, there's a comic artist that did a drawing which I found absolutely marvelous. This guy comments the news with characters that all look like Mr. Potato Head. And when I saw this drawing, I thought, I've got to show this to you guys. I asked him for the authorization to show it at this conference, and not only did he agree, but he lettered in the translation of the text for me. So I hope you will think of him when you look at this. Is broadband a utility? That's his answer. There you have it. Is it like electricity? I don't know. But sooner or later, we're going to have to think about that. Thank you very much.